Hammers, for instance, are good for lots of things. Building birdhouses, bludgeoning ideological opponents, breaking down and becoming present at hand. But a hammer is obviously designed in such a way that certain purposes, driving nails, are more plausible than others. For Kenneth Burke, poetry is designed for living. Poetry is produced as part of the Consolatio Philosophiae. It is undertaken as equipment for living, as a ritualistic way of arming us to confront perplexities and risks. It would protect us. I like the notion that the aesthetic is conceived in response to threat. Burke reminds us that implicit in the notion of protection is the idea of something to be protected against, risks and perplexities. The shit that, in the vernacular version, happens. What Burke does not mean by equipment for living is conveyed by Kenneth Koch's line, "People say, yes, everyone is dying. But here, read this happy book on the subject." Poetry doesn't kiss the boo-boo and make it all better. Burke suggests that poems be viewed as strategies for dealing with situations. He doesn't say this is the only way to view them. The structural defects of our existence require of us strategic thinking. Burke consults some dictionaries and discovers that strategy has to do with the movement and directing of armies. Surely the most highly alembicated and sophisticated work of art, arising in complex civilizations, could be considered as designed to organize and command the army of one's thoughts and images, and to so organize them that one imposes upon the enemy the time and place and conditions for fighting preferred by oneself. One seeks to direct the larger movements and operations in one's campaign of living. Burke rejects the strategy for easy consolation found in popular inspirational literature, art as uplift, paper armies raised on the cheap. "All the redemption I can offer," Bruce Springsteen admits, "is beneath this dirty hood." In The Triumph of Love, Jeffrey Hill asks, "What are poems for?" His answer, borrowed from Giacomo Leopardi, is not without its self-directed irony. "They are to console us with their own gift, which is like perfect pitch. Let us commit that to our dust. What ought a poem to be? Answer, a sad and angry consolation. What is the poem? What figures? Say, a sad and angry consolation. That's beautiful. Once more, a sad and angry consolation." The repetition of Leopardi's phrase forms a call and response, with the emphasis shifting as each adjective ends a line in turn. But as if to underscore the unromantic tenor of Hill's vision, the exchange is hardly, "Can I get an amen?" No one's likely to get fired up over, "Once more, a sad and angry consolation." But the words return, a refrain, as a trauma is repeated in Freud's Beyond the Pleasure Principle, and we are to commit them to the dust unto which, Genesis tells us, we shall return, the dirty hood of the grave. The mantra-like repetition of a sad and angry consolation makes the words seem less clear, more in need of interpretation. The question that forces itself is, of course, how something consoling can be sad and angry, or how sorrow and anger can console, when these would seem to be precisely the conditions for which sufferers need consolation. Boethius would have understood. He composed De Consolatione Philosophiae in prison, awaiting execution. According to one reputable source, a cord